Hello out there. As some of you may know, especially since we started broadcasting as a podcast, at the beginning and end of every show, I always encourage you to visit our website and click on the donate button. But today I'm going to do something a little different. Last week, the internet banded together with encouragement from celebrities like Ricky Gervais and Jimmy Kimmel to condemn the killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe by the American dentist Walter Palmer, who Jimmy Kimmel called the most hated man in America who didn't sell Jell-O pudding. And it was a tragedy that need not have happened, because let's face it, trophy hunting is an appalling hobby. I refuse to call it a sport. It's just stupid, and I just feel sorry for Mr. Palmer that he suffers from having a dick so small that he has to shoot these beautiful, majestic animals. Anyway, please visit wildcru.org, wildcru.org, and give money to them and help with their conservation efforts, and let's turn this tragedy into a positive. Now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to Endeavors, broadcasting to you from wherever you are, wherever you may have been, or wherever you may be headed. I'm Dan. I will guide you through this mastery of talk for the next hour or so. It's a fantastic show today. I've got actress Maya Taylor from the amazing film Tangerine. She talks about what it's like to be a transgender actress and how far we've come in transgender rights in the last year. You'll also hear from Jeremy Jaramillo from the Semicolon Tattoo Project in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He talks about what it is and how tattoos and mental health are inextricably linked. And we'll also feature the music of the wonderful Colleen Renison from her solo project. Her new album is See the Sky About to Rain. And that's where we're going to start today. This is the title track off of her album.
So blowing through my brain.
my first guest is an actress known for her breakthrough role in the remarkable movie Tangerine, directed by Sean Baker. She is Maya Taylor, and I spoke to her on Sunday from her home in Los Angeles. Maya Taylor, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this film, Tangerine, it's very unique and very interesting. I'm curious as to how you became involved with a project such as this. I think one of the most unique aspects about this film is that it was shot on iPhones. What did you make as an actress of that creative decision by Sean Baker?
Well, it all started with budget, because we didn't have a large budget. It wasn't actually planned. You know, a lot of people think that it was planned, you know, to make a movie with an iPhone. But, you know, if you ask me about it, I just did another movie. It was called Happy Birthday, Marsha. I can't tell you when it's going to be released or anything, because I haven't gotten any information about it. I haven't talked to my directors. I tried to call her today, but she was really, really busy. But in that movie, we used a large camera. And Tangerine was my first movie. And, you know, I didn't really notice the difference in, like, the cameras or anything. I mean, because it's obvious. You know, you don't look at the camera. I'm naturally gifted with acting, so it didn't make a difference whether it was being shot with an iPhone or a big studio camera to me.
I think there's two really important aspects of this film that I wanted to touch on briefly, that have been, you know, that I think that are important in terms of their social justice content. One is, of course, the exposure of trans people and trans rights, and the other is sort of the rights of sex workers, especially in a year like this, where we've seen so much positive movement for trans visibility. How do you think a film like Tangerine helps the dialogue in that area in regards to trans visibility?
You know, a lot of people have come to me. Well, in a lot of interviews, a lot of people mentioned the sex working part of the film, and you know, I don't really understand why that sticks out so much, because if it was a film about cisgender male and female people, you know, doing sex work or whatever, then, you know, that part wouldn't be brought up much. It just wouldn't. But since it happens to be transgender people who happen to be sex workers, even though the movie is mainly about friendship, why does sex work always stand out to everybody? But the answer to your question is, the sex work part of this film, it's true. It's just, it's real. It's the reality and everything. And a lot of people turn a blind eye to it. I myself have done sex work as a trans woman. And the reason why is because it's so hard to get a job when you're trans. And, you know, for me, it's not, you know, it's not by looking at me. It's about what my ID had said at that time. You know, my ID still had a male's name on it, even though I looked like a girl. And that's what always gave me away, and I couldn't get a job. So when we made the film, I wanted everything to be brutally real and honest, like just raw material. Even a lot of the girls that you see, like, background of the film and everything, is a sex worker, but a lot of those girls were sex workers too. So I want people to know, trans people, a lot of trans people have to do sex work because the employment is like, it's almost impossible for us, unless you're just lucky, you know. I just want it to be like more noticed, you know, that we're having such a hard time trying to get employment that we have to do sex work. It's a true fact. Well, think about how many trans people are in the porn industry, because that's all we can do. That's all people are allowing us to do. Like, there's not that many opportunities for us. So, yeah. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, definitely. You know, and something else I wanted to touch on, this week in Vancouver was our Pride week. In fact, today we just had our Pride parade. why is an event like that important to you as a trans person?
For pride?
Yeah, like
gay pride?
Yeah. Or is it? Because I know in some circumstances there's been a lot of phobias towards the trans community, even within the queer community, I've been told. But how do you approach an event like Pride?
Well, you're a very, very smart man, and you know a lot. I'm glad you brought that up, you know, about the phobias and things like that. This is what I have to say. I actually just talked to Laverne Cox. She called me 3 or 4 days ago, and I talked to her about the same subject. I told her, I don't understand this whole LGBT umbrella. Let me explain this to you. LGB, lesbian, gay, and bisexual are sexual orientation. T and Q are gender identity. That's how people identify themselves. You know, I'm trans.
Right.
Transgender. That's how I identify. I actually hate that... Yes, I know hate is a strong word, but I have to say it. I just have to be honest. I hate that the T is with the L, G, and B. I just feel like it does not belong. So when it comes to pride and everything, it does, for me personally, it doesn't really do as much to me. Like, it doesn't, I don't know. I can't say that it doesn't really mean anything to me, because it does, I guess, but I don't know how to explain it. I'm kind of stuck in the middle of it.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the fact about LGBT, because I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about, you know, how the acronym is ever expanding, and should we continue to use the acronym, or should we just say the queer community is more of all, sort of more all-encompassing? What is your take on that?
Well, everything's so confusing with that, because queer and questioning, I think those two are kind of together, but that's in a totally different category than trans and lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. They're like, it's all like totally different. But like, I just feel like the T, transgender, should not be put with LGB. Because, okay, think about it like this. This is what I hate. I hate when I have to tell somebody, oh yeah, well, I'm trans. And then they'd be like, oh, well, that's no problem. I have a lot of gay friends. It really, really pisses me off, because it's like, that's not the same thing. And
right.
It's nowhere near, like, even, like, close to being the same thing. Because this is how I identify as a woman. Like, I've always identified as a woman. That's what I was born as mentally. And then I have to go through all these different things to change my body to make it match up to what was going on in my head. I date a straight guy who he's a man, you know, and right. I am a woman. That's just how our relationship is. We have a heterosexual relationship. And the whole lesbian, gay, and bisexual thing, like, I don't think that's not for us.
Right.
I just happen to be a trans woman with a cisgender male as my boyfriend.
You mentioned that...
Does that make sense, or is it...
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying. You mentioned that the great Laverne Cox called you a couple days ago, and she's been sort of touted as either, you know, the poster child for transgender people, you know, with her role on Orange is the New Black. You know, she's a lot of people says she's helped bring a certain amount of awareness and education about what it is to be trans and specifically a trans woman. Within this past year or two, how far do you think we have gone in terms of understanding the rights of trans people?
You know, I definitely want to say we've made a lot of progress. You know, it's a huge step that we've taken, especially with all the trans people being in Hollywood. especially, you know, I think who's made the biggest step for us is Caitlyn Jenner.
Right.
Because her story, she came out so publicly to where when she came out and she told her story, it helped people to understand us and why we are trans, you know, why we transitioned from whatever sex we were before to whatever sex we're transitioning to now. And it helped people to just understand, because a lot of people wanted to know why. And, you know, a lot of people who don't, like, if people don't understand something, then they make fun of it or they act horribly against it. So Caitlyn has really helped out a lot. But also, a lot of the murders for trans people have went up, and I do not understand that. Like, it's went up, even considering the fact that we have all of this, what's the word I'm looking for? All the representation with Laverne, myself, Caitlyn Jenner, Kiki Katana Rodriguez, Carmen Carrera, Janet Mock, all of us, T.S. Madison, and, like, still a lot of murders have, like, just came up of just trans people. So I don't understand it.
Well, the film is Tangerine. It's an excellent, excellent piece of art. I encourage everyone who is listening to go see it. Maya Taylor, thanks so much for your time, and thank you so much for your bravery.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No worries. Have a good night, and happy Pride, and best of luck.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Cheers. Bye-bye. My next guest is a Gemini Award-winning actress and singer who has appeared in such movies as Carpool with Tom Arnold, The Story of Us with Michelle Pfeiffer and Bruce Willis, and Beautiful, starring Minnie Driver and directed by Sally Field. You may know her from her music career as the lead singer of No Sinner. She's now released a solo album called See the Sky About Terrain. She is Colleen Renison, and I spoke with her last week. Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Yes, in this the one day of rain we've had in about 3 weeks here.
Everyone's so happy.
Yeah, I've never seen a city so happy for rain.
Yeah, especially a city that's notorious for getting too much of it. But yeah, I'm happy. It looks like the park across the street's pretty happy about it too.
Let's talk about this album, See the Sky About Terrain. What made you decide to do something separate and away from your band and sort of a more solo project?
Well, I always knew that was something that I wanted to do, and the opportunity presented itself when Steve Dawson got in touch with me. I had done some work with Jim Burns and Steve. They were working on Jim's album, and yeah, we sat down, had a meeting at the Foundation a couple years ago, and just, I mean, we sort of concocted it. It needed to be half Canadian content, so whether that was going to be original songs that me and Steve wrote or covers was yet to be decided, but I sort of saw the opportunity to sort of dig into the Canadian songbook and play some songs that were favorites from my childhood, you know? And yeah, I mean, we batted around a lot of classics and a lot of B-sides and songs that I thought were definitely going to be on the album. Some of them didn't end up on it, but we hashed it out for a while, and then, in 5 days of recording, did it all up.
Wow.
Yeah, all pretty much live off the floor in his little henhouse studio in East Van. It was awesome. It was a great experience.
You do have quite a unique voice, and I think I read, isn't that what caused you to leave theater school?
I don't know if it caused me to leave or caused me to get pushed out. yeah, I mean, I guess in the theater world is unlike the acting world and totally unlike the music world. When I left Circle in the Square, I don't know if it was really more, I just didn't really feel welcome there. It was a great school, and I learned a lot. But the theater community is a really, really tight-knit one, and it's a very disciplined one. And the rock and roll community, I mean, there's obviously discipline there, but it's a totally different vibe. And that It's definitely more my tribe than theater. But they were. I mean, it was a great experience. But I mean, basically, they told me that I would never work, and that I was untrained vocally, and that there was no helping me, and all this other stuff. But it's a process that I have an utmost respect for. I mean, the amount of discovery I did about myself and art, and you know what it means to be dedicated to a craft, and sort of I called it like the excavation of like the human like mind and spirit, and body as well. I mean, the physical acting. We did all these crazy exercises. I think that everybody should do it.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, how, you talk about that access to emotion, and I'm curious as to how that helps you in your songwriting abilities per se. You know, having access to those different channels of emotion.
They did. I think about it every day, and certainly every day that I perform. I don't know, just trying to get to the quick of the matter and the truth of your own emotions. You know, the thing about acting that a lot of people don't know is that it's not about pretend. It's about the truth. You know, it's about finding the truth inside of the text and the story for yourself. And I think that I always try and write from that place, whether it's something fictional or if it's an autobiographical sort of standpoint that I'm writing from. It's always important to find like the essence of the real human emotion and human condition, and that I think is what I relate to in music and in lyrics and in poetry and in, I mean, in just in art in general, is that
how much truth for you came out when you were making See the Sky About Terrain, just like on a creative level, let's say.
Actually, that's I related to a lot of them, and a lot of them were songs from my childhood and songs that were really close to me growing up, or that just, I mean, music makes me cry all the time, and these are some of my favorite songs, so unfortunately sometimes when I'm performing them they make me cry, and I guess there's, whether I can describe it or not, there's some truth there.
And I know speaking of your musical exploits, I know, is this true when you were first starting out as a musician that you got to work with David Foster?
It was a contest. I mean, I got to go to David Foster's studio, and I got to sing for him, and I got to play at a show that he was at, and he was a very nice man, but I didn't get to like work with him, but he was, I mean, I guess so, if he was putting on the show that I performed at, but that was pretty cool, that was pretty surreal. I one of the first songs that I ever performed was I Will Always Love You, and he produced that.
Oh,
so
wow.
That was cool. Standing in his studio and seeing his gold records for that song on the wall, platinum records.
Yeah.
What
makes a good show for you? Like, how do you, like, you get off stage and you're like, we really just nailed it tonight?
So many things. There, I mean, for different things contribute to that feeling. You know what I mean? At any given time, but it's this. I mean, it's the sum of a few things. Usually, it's an attentive audience. It doesn't necessarily have to be a large audience, but just, and you can feel it. I don't know really how to describe it, but you just know when you're connecting, and that's always what you want, and that's always kind of the most important thing. And then also connecting to the music with your musicians, and connecting, like, sometimes I'll be thinking about what I ate for lunch, you know, and when I'm singing a song, and that's another distraction. It's not the outside things, sometimes it's the internal things too. You just try and be in the moment and find and stick to, you know, finding the truth of the whole thing, you know?
Yeah,
or making, not necessarily you have a better show, but have it be more
real.
Connecting, it can be harder for you. That's the thing. It's like, sometimes the best performance hurts, you know? Sometimes I think that's like the art, when you talk about that in general. I mean, some of the greatest masterpieces in the world took, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of probably heart-wrenching personal discovery. And it's not always peaches and cream, you know. It's not, you're not writing jingles.
So I know that one of the songs on See the Sky About Terrain is Whiskey Whiskey.
Yeah, that's my favorite song.
Which is a fantastic track. I just love the way it flows.
Thank you. It's my favorite. I think it's my favorite on the album.
And in honor of that, and I know actually I did a review a couple years ago, and I jokingly ended it as, because I was talking to one of the band members, and I jokingly ended it as that, and never try to outdrink Colleen Renison.
Yeah.
So in honor of that and in Whiskey Whiskey, what is Colleen Renison's favorite cocktail?
I don't really drink cocktails. My favorite cocktail is an Amaretto Sour.
Ooh, nice choice.
With like the real deal, with egg whites and fresh lemon. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. The first time I ever had one was at the Frolic Room in Los Angeles on Hollywood and Vine. And it's apparently the oldest bar in Los Angeles because it was built, I don't know, you can quote me on this, but you can also quote me on the fact that I'm saying I don't know if this is 100% true. But I was told by some old guy there that it was the first bar ever because it was built during the Prohibition.
Oh, wow.
And it was like the backstage. It's right next to the theater. I think it's the El Capitan Theater. Is that what it is? I don't know. No, I don't think it is. But it's near the... Anyway, not important. It's still a working, actors theater, I believe. I don't know. Maybe don't quote me on that. Anyways, Frolic Room, Hollywood and Vine. Apparently, it was the first... it was the first bar in Los Angeles, and the oldest bar in Los Angeles. And it's dark and seedy, and they've got a jukebox, and they've got an awesome mural on the wall that was done by one of the classic artists that does his illustrations for the New Yorker.
Okay.
Of all the sort of celebrities of that time. And, you know, there's Marilyn Monroe, there's Groucho Marx, you've got... oh gosh, who else is on there? It's amazing. I think Jane Meadows is on there. It was an experience. So I will always relate that drink to that experience. And whenever I want to get something fancy, that's usually what I order. If I'm not drinking cheap beer or bottom shelf whiskey, then I'll probably have an Amaretto Sour.
There's a lot of good breweries here in Vancouver. What do you like locally?
Well, Red Truck treated us really well, so that was really nice of them. I'm so bad. I've partied off the rail a few times. I've gone... What's the one? I always forget the names. One that's just up on Main Street around the corner from the Whip. It's a Brass Neck Brewery. Yeah, that place is a good time. And then I like the Growler. It's very... it's very modern. It's very green. Reusing the glass bottles makes it a bit of an experience, you know? I like it. I mean... Usually you'll see me with a six-pack of Pabst in a park. But occasionally if I'm feeling classy or somebody else has got a growler, we'll partake in that. It's cool how they've got the food trucks outside.
Yeah.
And that they've kind of, like, those two sort of new trends have teamed up and are feeding off of each other. I think that's pretty neat.
The overall music scene in Vancouver, it's changed at all in the last few years. What's your take on sort of where
it's changed a bit? It's not as tightly knit, I feel like, or maybe I'm just out of the loop, but I don't feel like it's as tightly knit as it used to be. But I don't really know. I mean, I guess it's all, music scene's always changing, right? I feel like it might be a little bit more disconnected and a little bit more cliquey. It felt like there was, or not cliquey, but the genres all really mixed together there for a while. There was such a bloom in the exchange of information and how you advertise shows, and a lot of people weren't very discriminatory about what kind of shows they went to. But now I feel like maybe there's more, people are a little bit more niche, and like they're not, I don't know, hearing about as many shows in different spheres of, like, that are outside of their own, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's expanded a lot, and there's a lot of bands in the city that I don't even know about, and I don't feel like it was like that a few years ago. I feel like it was just a little bit, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just from my standpoint.
But I also think it has to do with just, like, you've been in the industry for so long now, both acting and singing. What would you sort of say to a, 8, 9, 10-year-old Colleen who's sort of just getting her feet wet?
I'd say stop hanging out with boys, learn how to skateboard and play the guitar, and your whole life will be amazing. That's exactly what I would say.
Okay.
That's don't worry, you'll grow up one day. You don't have to do it now. Pick up a guitar and learn how to skateboard. Okay. That's what I would say.
Did you learn how to skateboard?
No. Okay. No, I didn't. I had a skateboard, and I did a little bit, but I think I hurt my teeth. Like, I knocked my teeth out when I was in the middle of filming a movie. So it was bye-bye skateboard. Hello, fake teeth.
So, when you were on Carpool, the two boys never put you on their skateboard?
They didn't have skateboards.
They didn't have one?
No, they were little dweebs. They didn't skate. Well, I had friends to skateboard. I had some older friends.
Okay.
I was always hanging out with the older kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, we see a lot of, you know, actors and actresses that are both, you know, singers and musicians as well. Why do you think there is such an ability for those people to have a crossover talent? Is it in their genes, or is it a love? Is there something about them that makes
it? Performing, and I think it goes back to what we talked about before, just about finding truth in text and things like that. It's not, I mean, if you come at them both sort of in the same way, yeah, I think it's the same sort of part of the brain, maybe, yeah. You know, it just depends on the ability and also the, you know, the confidence and the need to perform and the need for public appreciation. It's probably the same part of the brain, and it's just another form of self-expression. So, makes sense, I would say.
Yeah. Well, the album is See the Sky About Terrain. It is a lovely, lovely, wonderful, soulful take on the great Canadian songbook.
Thank you.
And Steve Dawson is a remarkable producer.
Yes, he is.
This has been fun.
Yeah, I'm so glad you made it.
That was Colleen Renison, and I spoke to her last week. My final guest is a mental health worker from New Mexico who works with the Agora Health Center. And they have started a really interesting initiative called the Semicolon Tattoo Project. You may have seen it going around Facebook of people with semicolon tattoos on their wrists. He will tell us all about it. His name is Jeremy Jaramillo, and I spoke to him last week. Jeremy Jaramillo, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. It sounds like a great opportunity for us. We appreciate it.
So you are one of the members of the Semicolon Tattoo Project. This is a very interesting sort of social justice blend thing that you guys got going on here. Where did the idea for this project start?
So, I mean, that's a little confusing as to exactly where the internet memes kind of started, but we were inspired by this imagery where, you know, the semicolon concept can be this concept of continuing. And so we got together, a few of us around here, and decided, why not make it into a tattoo instead of something that people were, you know, posting as a picture or drawing it on their arm. We said, let's make it into a tattoo event. And, you know, we think that people always ask about each other's tattoos. It's a way that you can start a conversation. It's a very socially acceptable way to introduce yourself to someone even. And, what better way to go ahead and share your story about whatever you're going through or made it through, and let everyone know that, you know, you're proud of who you are and what you accomplished.
I read that sort of the idea behind the semicolon was that it was a continuation of a sentence, and so the semicolon signifies survival in a way. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we use it a little bit more specifically for mental health. So, you know, we're over at Agora, we are an all-issue helpline. So we're hoping people, you know, consider the period, maybe the suicide or the maybe the dilemma, the situation they're going through, but exactly as you say, they decide to continue to push through, and of course with this symbol, hopefully with everybody else as well as the support. So this is, you know, an anti-stigma campaign, and it's also a very personal thing that people put on their bodies and carry with them on a day-to-day basis.
You said something important there, which was stigma. And
yeah.
How much, you know, both in the United States and Canada, there's a lot of discussions happening right now around mental health. But
yeah.
what for you, what do you see as the main stigma associated with mental health that we need to try and eliminate?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that people see mental health issues, depression, or any of the things that we diagnose people with. They see them as kind of things if you just think harder about, or if you just try harder. But we never say that to someone who has maybe cancer or diabetes, you know. Just think better about that cancer and you'll feel better. You'll get through it. So we expect people to snap out of mental health issues. You know, this is literally a physical issue because, you know, your brain is an organ in your body. So I think that's the biggest one. There's many, though. Stigma about getting help, stigma about medication, stigma about, you know, not taking your medication, et cetera. There's so much to talk about, and this symbol provides the opportunity for that.
On the subject of medication, I think one of the issues that we're seeing now more associated with mental health is drug addiction, whether it's prescription or street drugs. How do we need to change the conversation around the use of drugs in order to help the conversation about mental health?
Goodness, I mean, I think it has to get a little complicated because, of course, at least in the United States, a very, very high number of people who die by suicide were under the influence of some type of substance, usually alcohol. So substance abuse, and now, as you basically implied, people using prescription drugs or abusing them is very much on the rise. And so we have to start talking about, you know, how mental health meds are different than other types of meds. For instance, they have different side effects. They don't work in an hour like your allergy medication that you expect. So I think we kind of have to get in the weeds with it, at least on a one-on-one basis with our physicians, if we're going to be taking them or if we decide not to. And then really also noticing that there's a lot of healthy choices you can make, right? So there's so much to think about, and, you know, self-medicating with alcohol or street drugs is not something we want to be doing when we're having some type of mental health issue. It definitely makes matters worse.
The idea of tattoos, you know, they're 20, 30 years ago, they were kind of this hip thing, and now everyone has one.
Such a different world, huh? To
a certain extent. I mean, compared to what it used to be. How can tattoos not only change a person's and their identity, but how they are perhaps perceived by those around them?
Excellent question. I mean, I think if someone has a tattoo, it is them. And so I think when we create something additionally on our body, it really alters our mindset. And that can be, you know, as a tattoo can be permanent, that mindset, you know, we can work on that being a permanent fixture of our body. As far as how it affects other people, you know, tattoos are much more widely accepted than when I was a child. However, I think that this is a way of, and as more people know the symbol, this is a way of people saying, oh, wow, that person at least supports mental health. They support, you know, stick-to-itiveness, perseverance, resolve, or they support someone who is suffering from this. And you don't even have to talk about it, but you can. So, you know, this is creating, like, you know, think about if you're in a subway or public area, you're going to see these things, and you're going to think, oh, I feel supported by that person that I don't know at all. We're actually coming up with a really great thing. If you stay tuned to our Facebook page, the Semicolon Tattoo Project, we're going to be having a way for people to interact all across the world with each other pretty soon. So that's what this is about.
I wanted to bring up that the social media aspect, because it seems like without social media, this project may not have been
possible in the way that it was. How do you think social media has affected our discourse and the way we talk about certain issues such as mental health?
Well, you know, those of us that have been in the mental health industry for so long, so I work for a crisis center, and I work with many crisis centers across at least the United States and some in Canada. Initially we kind of thought, well, maybe social media is going to be a problem, and it does create other issues, but for the most part, I think it creates a lot of opportunity. Social media obviously lets us talk to each other in a very fast-paced way. We create new social norms on social media that in a way that we couldn't before. But effectively for our project, you know, we're looking at a situation where, you know, we're getting mail from all over the world. And we went from being like a 3+ year old organization that was based in, you know, Albuquerque, New Mexico, to now being international and, you know, really just trying to get that word across the world with some partners and such. But yeah, it's impossible without social media, impossible.
What have you noticed sort of since this project really became known? I mean, I think I probably first found out about it maybe about a month ago. What have you noticed at all, if any, about just the dialogue that people are having, maybe about mental health, maybe about tattoos, maybe about sort of the combination of the two? Have you noticed any significant changes?
The thing of most significance is that this works for anything and everybody. I don't care if I need to make it through school, or I need to, you know, get out of an abusive relationship, or I need to get through, you know, a debilitating illness or condition. It works for everybody. It's very personalizable. So there's that element. And then this is very cross-generational. I know for our first 2 years, we had our tattoo day event. We've done around 600 tattoos plus of the real tattoos. We're also at our Facebook page, we're sending out stories with temporary tattoos. But anyway, we would have like multi-generation coming in. We'd have a daughter, a mother, and a grandmother coming in and getting this tattoo for some or multiple people in the family. And it's just allowing us to talk about mental health issues like we haven't been able to before. Everybody loves it because they can make it their own. People even design their own version of the semicolon tattoo. We have a couple different versions that we'll be promoting on our website a little bit more soon. So, and they mean a lot more. So we have a second year where you add more tails to it, and that we call it the Trinity. And then we have one, when you add 3 more tails, it turns into the actually a sun, and we call it Sol Invictus, which, so of course in Spanish, Sol means sun, but Sol Invictus means unconquered soul. So, and there's so much to do with this, and you're just so excited that it's reaching all over the world and people are participating when they've never met us or know of our program yet.
Well, I think part of it has to do, you know, at least initially, people may not be aware of what the term mental health means, or when they hear it, they have a specific view, a very specific narrow view of sort of the general idea of it. But how would you describe it, and how sort of mild or extreme can it be in sort of the spectrum of illness?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we do use the term mental illness plenty, but, you know, we prefer to use the term mental health. And I think that all in all, this is just a struggle or a lifelong goal, at least for everybody. So I don't mean to be dodging your question here at all, but, you know, yes, a tremendous amount of people have mental health issues. It's in the United States, it's at least a third of our country has some form of at least anxiety, all the way up to more serious things, especially, you know, we have 57 point some million people in the United States with depression. So mental illness is serious, but I think like mental health, that's about, you know, those things you do for self-care, for, you know, relaxing during the day, being with community, being with friends and family members. So I think mental health is pretty much, if not the biggest goal you'll ever have in your life.
I want to jump back to the social media issue for a second, because you had mentioned that, yes, it creates other problems. And I know one of the things we've seen is online bullying, you know, whether it's Facebook, yeah, YouTube, or anything like that. So what do you make of the fact that, you know, the people who are driven offline because of bullying are then coming back online to get help from such an organization as yours? It's a little bit of a vicious circle then, wouldn't you say?
Well, I mean, if it goes in that direction, I would call it glorious, to be honest. I mean, if I don't want anyone to be bullied at all, but if they must be bullied, if that must exist in our world, then we would love for them to find some solace and some reinforcement, some validation in the Semicolon Tattoo Project and then other projects there and the like. There's tons of us, right? A types of mental health prevention or mental health promotion project. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think at the Crisis Center, we get a little lucky because, you know, when we see someone getting bullied and that gets brought to our attention, it's because there's, you know, an army of, you know, our Facebook or followers or our, you know, people we've trained, et cetera, looking out for those people, trying to, you know, give them reinforcing messages, encouraging messages. So from the Crisis Center standpoint, you know, we know there's a lot of great people out there just trying to do their part to help each other and to tell the bullies, like, leave alone.
I know, at least in Obama's, you know, last little while, he's doing a lot of things to try and help the conversation, whether it's about prison reform or about, you know, the gun issue in the States. Do you see either of those issues playing into mental health at all, or is that a loaded question?
It's a loaded question, and terrible pun too, I guess, with guns. But I noticed that till I said it. But I guess, you know, we at our center, we don't take a stand on, you know, gun violence prevention, etc. We stay out of that political foray, but it remains to be known that in our country, if you took away the suicide deaths, you take away half of all firearm deaths in our country, which is a tremendous amount. So, I mean, firearms and, you know, safe gun ownership versus not so safe on it is really an addressable issue. And, you know, I think there's plenty of organizations that do address that issue. And, you know, I think it's important that we do. That's not particularly our thing, but we just like to be honest about it.
What would you like to see happen next in terms of dialogue or education about mental health?
You know, I think the first next is really just, you know, really trying to get like a social media change that turns into a social change. And that's a very, very difficult thing. There are very few campaigns that have done even a nationwide type of impact that has lasted. And you know, we look at a few of those in like the Truth campaign for anti-tobacco. That had tremendous social change. You know, it remains to be seen if those of us working in this mental health field can make that type of change working collectively. Now, if that's the case, you know, honestly, I'd really like it to be very comfortable for people to be able to, you know, get mental health. You know, instead of saying I always say this, instead of saying on Friday at 5 p.m. after work, you know, God, I've had a worst week, I've got to go get a drink. Maybe for a few of us to say I've had the worst week, I'm glad I get to see my therapist, my counselor, or I'm glad I get to, you know, talk to my friends about, you know, how I'm doing this weekend or tonight, et cetera. So, leaving it very open, and I think that will lead to people, you know, not being shamed to get some type of help and get it quickly. You know, let's get tons more social workers and therapists out there. One thing I will promote vehemently or excitedly, at least, is we need more mental health clinicians out there, more social workers taking care of us. And guess what, folks? That costs money. So
is part of it to do with fear of asking for help for a lot of people, do you find?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, I hate to reinforce the stigma, but effectively we kind of look at people who need mental health assistance as weak, and that's what we're trying to fight. Instead of being weak, they're actually just normal. They have issues like the rest of us do, and we need to protect our friends and family members too. So yeah, we need to get rid of that stuff. And there is a lot of stigma to getting help, and it's not an easy situation, right? Getting a therapist or getting on medication, if you want to, and I'm by no means promoting medication for everybody, but getting on those, routines, whether it be, exercise instead of medication or self-care, et cetera, it takes work. And, we're already trying to make a living and take care of our families, and it's extra work. But we think it's worth it.
Well, the semicolon tattoo project is definitely a very bold and innovative strategy and initiative to tackle the mental health issue. Jeremy Jaramillo, thank you so much for joining me today.
Of course, and let me please throw out, we'll have a new website coming up, but please visit our Facebook page, the Semicolon Tattoo Project. On Facebook currently, and if you do need help, I know you guys are a lot in Canada, but if you can call into the U.S., 1-866-HELP-1NM is our crisis line, and agoracares.org is where you can talk to us online if you need to reach out. So let's make sure and give people avenues to talk to people that will listen and be there for them.
Yes,
as much as we can.
Don't be afraid to reach out. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, ciao.
Bye.
Well, that is our show for this week. My thanks to Maya Taylor, my thanks to Jeremy Jaramillo, and my thanks to Colleen Renison. You can follow me on Twitter at Endeavors Radio. You can find us on Facebook at Pods with Benefits, or you can visit our website at podswithbenefits.com. If you like the show, support it. Also, please give to wildcrew.org and help animal conservation efforts everywhere, especially in the wake of the senseless death of Cecil the Lion. We are going to take you out with another song from Colleen's album, See the Sky About the Rain. This is Whiskey Whiskey. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye. Oh,
With you.